part of the program here, and Carl Custard of all on Dick Brown from the University of Sydney, well known for his heartbreaking, and I think personally quite brilliant book, called The Chase Across the Globe, still very important, perhaps the best, I think the best account of globalization from Marx's point of view, and who subsequently has worked with his colleague Michael Rafferty on derivatives, as most of you will probably well know.
Thank you. Would you like to keep talking, Jim? Very nice of you. Hey, I've written a paper here, or Mike Rafferty and I've written a paper with a title called A Time and a Place for Everything, Foundations of Commodity Money. I'm not really sure why I called it that. And I have changed what I've written a little bit to take account of some of the contributions made yesterday afternoon at the plenary. To kick off from the title that I gave, the proposition really that I want people to think about is that in terms of understanding the current financial crisis, if you sort of were able to drag someone out of the late 19th century and say, come and join us for a little while, what's your experience of the crisis? They might be inclined to say, what crisis? Because their concept of money would be gold. And they would say, well, there hasn't been much volatility in the price of oil or other commodities. I'm doing pretty well out of the stock market, etc. I mean, or if you were to pick someone from a different locality in terms of the reference to price, we know if you're living a life predominantly in one particular currency, you're having a different experience of the global financial world than if you live your life predominantly in another currency. I guess the point I really wanted to get to with that little statement was, we need to face the reality that there is no single global monetary unit. That the value of money itself is contested. And maybe one of the things we need to be thinking about in understanding the current financial crisis is that all the attention is currently being focused on finance, and not enough of the attention is being focused on money and the challenge to the concept of money. The thing is that money is innately unstable because the value of money is contested. Yet we seem to live in an environment at the moment where people think the volatility of money is itself a problem. Not that I'm suggesting that the full-blown crisis that we're currently seeing is a norm, but there is a judgment implicit in a whole lot of contributions that I'm seeing that says a money unit that is not stable is a money unit that is in crisis. And it's just not true. I mean, money is contradictory. The measurement of things in terms of money is not like measuring litres or yards, where everyone says, I know what a litre is, I accept what a litre is. You don't go into the marketplace to find out how long a yard is today and that it might crash overnight. These are just units of measure that are established, and we like to think about money that way, but we are wrong thinking about money that way. So I suppose What I'm observing in a lot of Marxist analyses of what's going on in the crisis is that it is based on this opining the absence of a stable monetary unit. So references to things like speculation, imprudence, greed, unsustainable growth of the finance part of capital, fictitious capital, they all have latent within them the notion that we are missing a stable monetary unit. And I say, who cares that we're missing a stable monetary unit? It is not a Marxist expectation to have one. In playing this out, let me nominate four pillars of what I think are received wisdom current in most Marxism, I'm not going to say in all Marxism, that I think is blocking an appreciation of how money has to be reinterpreted, re-understood in the context of the current crisis. These four pillars, as I've called them, they're blocking what I think is new about finance, and we need to focus on what is new. So let me nominate them briefly in turn. Firstly, I think there seems to be too much a universal assumption or acceptance that money is a product of the state. It's taken from Knapp, or Keynes through Knapp, this proposition that the state issues money, the state determines what money is. It was offered to the world back in 1918, back in the 1920s, as a historical proposition. Now, the people who developed it might have been saying, we believe this is the new eternal form of money. Straight after the formation of central banks, it is a very historically specific concept of money to attach money to the state. Yet it has been elevated to theoretical standing. States define what money is, and I think we need to challenge that. And to challenge it, we reopen the possibility that there may be commodity foundations to money. What those are is something I'll get to shortly. So that's the first thing I want to challenge, this direct association of money and the state. The second thing I want to challenge is the extent to which I see most Marxists adopting a quite neoclassical conception of what money is based in those five functions of money, you know, means of exchange, standard of deferred payment, store of value, etc. And the problem here is that when you define money in terms of functionalism, of course, any breakdown of the money system is being defined as money becoming dysfunctional. And what we're seeing at the moment is a whole lot of description of the current money system as dysfunctional, and it's throwing Marxists towards the issue of saying we need to refunctionalize money. So getting into these debates about how do we regulate, you know, what taxes should we put on, how can we restabilize the money system? And I'd say, sure, these are interesting and important questions, but they're not Marxist questions. Other people can answer those questions. We don't have to be the ones who sit around thinking up the new regulatory regime. It's not for Marxists to make money functional. Money in a Marxist theory is not about functionalism. It is about contradictions, and it's about the way in which money mediates contradictory social relations. The third pillar that concerns me is the separation of the real and the financial. And it was being talked about in yesterday's plenary as if it was self-evident that there is a distinction between a real economy and a financial economy, as if there is some real capitalist economic activity that is devoid of finance. Somewhere out there, there is a real pure activity and finance sits outside it, as if there is no distinction between surplus labour and surplus value, that you can conceive of a capitalist economy almost as barter. And it sounds to me remarkably like monetarism, yeah? This separation of the real and the financial. And I just don't understand it, and I think the critical issue we need to be looking at is how is that division between, or that so-called distinction between the real and the financial, how is it blurring? And what's the significance of it blurring? Excuse me. And I think the fourth pillar that I want to challenge is the notion that finance is being conceived through the credit system. Marx's concept of what is money? Well, money is credit. And it's nice in one level because it takes us straight to social relations. You know, credit is about obligations, social obligations into the future. So immediately it makes money social. But it's a very narrow and limited way of making money social. And surely there is something new, something innovative about money that means describing it as credit is not wrong. It's just, surely we can say more than that it's credit. So I have for a few years now been working on financial derivatives, as Jim said, and the issue or the possibility that we should see derivatives as having money-like characteristics. They are not simply money. They are not simply capital. They are somewhere in between money and capital, and that they can be used variously as capital or as money. They blur the categories of money and capital. And in the act of blurring the distinction between money and capital, or if you like, money and commodities, I think we're getting closer to the point of saying a distinction between the financial and the real can't work. It's not a useful distinction for us to try and draw. Today, if we think about the commodity attributes of finance, we can get a richer appreciation of what's going on in financial markets. We can see financial markets as integral to capitalism rather than an assault on capitalism, an assault on some idealised capitalism in which money is neutral. The politics is not simply that we need to engage, is not simply about taming finance so that the real economy might flourish. It is about understanding the way in which finance is integral to understanding the contradictions of capitalism. So to push on a little bit, let me give you two illustrations of why I think it is important, useful, to think about money in terms of commodities and commodities in terms of money, that the categories need to blur. One is the concept of a subprime loan. We generally think of subprime loans, and we've been talking about subprime loans, as credit, overexpanded credit, credit given imprudently, etc., but we just think about it in the discourse of credit. We don't think about it at all in the discourse of commodities. But think about the nature of what lies within a subprime contract. The people who designed these subprime contracts, they didn't produce loans based on interest rate spreads. The source of profitability here was not the credit process of borrowing cheap and lending dear. They produced products. And here's the nature, roughly, of these products. They said, how can we structure a product that gives us an asymmetric exposure to house prices, an asymmetric upside and downside exposure to house prices? And what they did was to say, effectively, we will sell off the downside exposure to house prices, the exposure to the price of a house falling, because we will securitize these mortgages. And let's be clear what securitization means. It means you don't sell off the mortgage, you sell off exposure to the performance of the mortgage. It is purely a price contract. The person who issues the mortgage can, they may sell it, but they hang on to the mortgage. They own the mortgage. They sell off exposure to the performance of the mortgage. So what's the asymmetry they created? You securitize the risk of house prices falling, but you hang on to your exposure for house prices increasing because you build into that contract huge charges, huge fees. And you rake out from these borrowers the whole of the growth of the house prices while the bubble's still going, by charging fees, rescheduling loans, getting people to come in, fees and fees and fees. And that's how the people who were issuing subprime loans, that's how they sought to make money, not by the difference between the borrowing rate and the lending rate. So in that sense, these are products. We think of them as selling a commodity, and that is going to reveal more about what's going on. These loans were designed to fail. That is not credit. That is a product, selling people a bung product. And to think about it in terms of the credit system misses that entirely. Let me give you another illustration of where I think we need to think about the merging of commodities and money. Mortgage-backed securities themselves. These are commodities. They're bought and sold in huge volumes in financial markets. But their liquidity also makes them money-like. So they are both capital, or commodities, and they are money at the same time. Think about who bought them. Sometimes they were bought, many of them were bought by investment banks. Investment banks treated them like capital. But so too did local government authorities buy them. And the thought process inside a local government authority was, we have some spare cash, will we put it in the bank on a term deposit? Will we buy treasury bonds? No, let's buy some mortgage-backed securities. So they are thinking about them in terms of money. Yeah, it's an alternative to a treasury bond or a bank deposit. But of course, what it signals is there is a risk-return element that comes into the concept of money. You know, these are different sorts of money that we're talking about here. And we define these different sorts of money in terms of their risk exposure. So notice, immediately we've moved away from a concept of state money as a unit of measure, a single universal entity, and we're starting to think about degrees of moneyness and different forms of money with different risk attached to them. This is money, but it is not state money. The whole concept of a store of value that we associate with money thereby starts to take on an element you can't think about a store of value outside of the concept of risk. Yeah? It just changes the way we think about what money is. But who else was involved in mortgage-backed securities? Well, we know that as soon as they lost their value, as soon as house prices fell or people stopped repaying their mortgages and these price exposures therefore fall quickly towards zero in their values, what happens is central banks say, we will treat them as money, but we will treat them as dud money. You bring in your grubby old valueless mortgage-backed securities and we will give you crisp new greenbacks. We will convert your, if you like, non-state money, it's not just money, you'll understand what I'm saying, but we will convert your non-state money into state money. So again, the state is acknowledging, in a sense, that a mortgage-backed security is a form of money, but it's not the conventional form of money that we've been associating with, that stuff that is issued by the state. What's the general point I'm getting to here? It is that there is no monetary anchor that is devoid of variability of value, and risk becomes integral to defining different degrees of moneyness and different forms of money. As Marxists, we can't leave risk out of a theory of value. So, to move on historically, when states don't guarantee the value of money, such as we know happened after 1971, and we have floating exchange rates and the withdrawal of banks from a whole lots of regulatory practices, and we find we exist in a globally integrated financial system with multiple currencies, we find we are directly exposed to the uncertainty in the value of money. What happens? Individuals or corporations, financial institutions, start to create a market for volatility. They commodify volatility. They produce derivatives. They say, we will package uncertainty about the future in interest rates, we will package uncertainty about the value of currencies, and we will sell uncertainty, or sell risk, if you like. And as a result of that, as a result of acknowledging that volatility and uncertainty are integral to the concept of money, we find people, corporations, financial institutions, go into markets and they have to trade and trade and trade, because the risks of different asset forms keep on changing on a minute-by-minute basis, and to maintain any semblance of stability in that market, you must keep trading. Now, the fact that it was a flawed system, the fact that it had contradictions and that it has crashed, doesn't deny that logic. So what we're really talking about here, then, is that we have created a market where money is inseparable from the concept of exposures to performances of assets. A very different concept of money. What sort of money is it? Well, here we get to the next analytical problem, because it's one thing to say that there's a blur, that we see that derivatives have money and securities have money-like attributes. They're not pure money, but they are on a spectrum of moneyness. What sort of money are they? They're clearly not state money. Indeed, if they were state money, the state wouldn't have to cash them in and revalidate these assets by giving them the imprimatur of the state. They would already have it. What sorts of money are they? They must logically be commodity money. Because if they're not state money, there's no other sort of money you can be. Clearly, they are not commodity money that is like gold. I mean, you think about gold, and that's where most people think about commodity money. Gold was valued because of its preciousness and its non-reproducibility, etc. That in its materiality, it was valued as a commodity and had another life. Derivatives and this security-based sort of money is not that sort of commodity. We are talking here about, if you like, a service sector notion of a commodity money. We are talking about a contractual content in money. And we're talking about a move to money which is not just functional for capital because it enables flexibility, but it embodies the contestability of the money unit itself. Money embodies its own contestability. Money is, in that sense, an embodiment of the class contradictions of a capitalist economy. And I think in that sense, we start to open up new possibilities for politics that are talking about the money system and the way we constitute money. It takes us out of the questions of how do we get back to a regulatory norm that will re-establish the stability of the money system. And we say what we treasure in this money, what we value about understanding money, is that it is the highest form of capitalist commodity. It is a pure price exposure, it is pure relativity, and it is pure profit. And I think I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. There are some seats here and at the front here. Then I was to look forward.